From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right, like peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, 3D movies seem to be raking in the dough. So why can't all theaters show films in 3D? Plus the hair-raising world of Hollywood fundraising and Hollywood power wives. But first, Peter Bart is out and Wall Street is down, on up. Coming up during the Hollywood News Banter. Stay close, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined in the studio by The Business producer, Matt Holzman. Let's start with Peter Bart.
Peter Bart, the venerable editor-in-chief of Variety, who's been there for 20 years, is out. He's actually up and out.
Well, he's been kicked upstairs. And I'll tell you, the press has sort of jumped on him. Peter Bart, known as a guy who, you know, did a lot of things to improve Variety, but also wielded his power sometimes as the editor of Variety as a blunt instrument.
And also was accused in a very damning article by Amy Wallace of some impropriety in his dealings with Hollywood. He was, of course, a former producer and vice president in charge of production at Paramount. He was there during the time that The Godfather was made, so obviously his tentacles went deep into show business.
Yes, he was apparently trying to hawk a script there, which would be a violation of the Variety ethics guidelines. And he was suspended for a period of time after Amy Wallace's article came out. I don't think they ever specified exactly why, but there were a raft of allegations, you know, and it was known in the industry that Peter Bart rewarded his friends and punished his enemies through the editorial pages of Variety.
In Hollywood, you know, Kel Shock.
And in a piece for Portfolio where Amy Wallace writes now, she updated the piece she had written for Los Angeles Magazine with another anecdote, recounting the tale of a studio chief who says that he went to lunch with Peter Bart at one point and was told that if he did not take out more ad pages in Variety, he would pay the consequences in the content. And every time a movie opened big, there would be an introductory phrase like, after a string of flops, a movie is finally opened big, which is typical of the kind of reputation that he had developed. So,
well, he is now the vice president and editorial director of Variety. Tim Gray, who's been working under Peter, is now the editor of the paper.
And facing a big challenge in the internet era with a bunch of bloggers and, you know, very quick reporting and sometimes just opinion, not really reporting. And it's going to be a rough road to hoe. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Okay, well, I want to go on my soapbox here. On April 6th, Brooks Barnes wrote an article for the New York Times called Pixar's Art Leaves Profit Watchers Edgy. And basically, his thesis is that the new movie Up that's coming out from Pixar at the end of May is not going to do particularly well. And people love to doubt Pixar. He's basing this assumption on a single Wall Street analyst, Richard Greenfield of Pally Research, who downgraded Disney's shares to sell last month because he saw a portion of the movie and he didn't like it. Now, when Wall Street analysts have become film critics, I don't know.
I think that it's fair for them to evaluate a film and decide whether it's going to make money. But, you know,
I don't.
Your point. Well, no, that's what they have to do.
I will say some of the points that he makes are good, which is that this is not a movie that's going to have a lot of merchandising money come in like a Toy Story. This is a movie which a lot of the companies involved in merchandising items from previous Pixar movies are not involved. So they don't expect to make a lot of money in merchandising. That is true. But for a single analyst to say, I'm going to downgrade a company stock based on a portion of a movie that he saw seems very odd to me.
Well, I would say that the one thing you wonder with Pixar, they've done very well. They've done what they want to do. At some point, if it becomes too much them indulging their artistic tastes and the movies start being less commercial, then you'll see a consequence and there will be a pressure to make them more commercial. But so far, Pixar is having the last laugh.
Well, I would argue, A, who trusts anybody on Wall Street anymore? And B, I think the reason that Pixar has succeeded is because they've stayed with what they believe was interesting films and not films that were commercial. That's why they've done so well. All right, that's my soapbox.
And when you spring to Pixar's defense, you actually remind me of that image of the Wolverine. You have those talons are out, you know, you're intense.
Wow, what a segue.
What a segue, huh? So Wolverine pirated and apparently more than a million illegal downloads of this movie, which is potentially, I mean, you can say, why do Wall Street analysts get to rate movies? But if that affects the income from Wolverine, which it easily could, that will go to Fox's bottom line.
Right now, Wolverine is the fourth installment of their X-Men series, and this is a franchise of films that has made well over $1 billion for Fox. So the fact that millions of people have seen the film online may cut into their bottom line, and that is a fact that you cannot argue. So I agree with that.
We did talk about Wolverine before, but what happened in the interim is that Roger Friedman, the Fox online gossip columnist, was fired for writing that he watched Wolverine. He actually gave it a positive review. Maybe he thought that would inoculate him from the wrath of Fox, but it didn't. And he found himself fired.
Right. Now, he had watched a copy of the film that he had downloaded. He didn't get it from the people at Fox. He got it off of the internet, and he was fired for that. What's interesting, of course, is that it shows that the line, that supposedly iron wall between journalism and the other parts of Fox, is not made of iron. It might be made of aluminum.
I don't even know if it's made of anything like other than gauze. And, you know, the point I make in a column that I wrote for the Daily Beast is that News Corp did not fire Richard Johnson of Page Six after he admitted that he had taken money from a businessman whose restaurant had been promoted on the pages of Page Six. So the question would be, what is of greater concern to News Corp? The idea that your gossip columnist is lining his pocket and abusing the space that has been given to him to supposedly report on news, or the problem of a gossip columnist doing something that is just foolish and, you know, arguably illegal, but still.
I guess we know the answer to that.
I think we've seen the answer, yes. And that's all the news that's fit to banter about. Coming up next, 3D, Wave of the Future or Scourge of the Past? In 2008, Jeffrey Katzenberg of DreamWorks Animation told me that 3D is the third great revolution in film.
The first is when movies went from silent films to talkies, and the second is when they went from black and white to color. And I believe what we are facing as an opportunity today is as great as either of those were. And in less than a handful of years, I think you will start to see the vast majority of movies will be made and shown in 3D.
Katzenberg might be right. 3D has been doing generally well, and his Monsters vs. Aliens had a $60 million opening weekend last month, and that was with a limited number of 3D screens. Every studio is rolling out big 3D titles, and some are even re-releasing 2D films in 3D, like Pixar's Toy Story. So, is digital 3D just a fad or the wave of the future? Our producer, Matt Holzman, spoke with David Wertheimer, CEO and Executive Director of the Entertainment Technology Center based at USC.
So how many 3D screens are there now, and how many will there be in the near future?
There are about 5,000 digital screens, and about of those 5,000, there are about 2,000 that are equipped for 3D.
And can you make any kind of prediction about how the transitional progress is going to 3D, how many screens we might have in a year or two?
Digital transition in theaters is all about taking out film projectors and putting in digital versions of them, and that is the thing that people are working out. There are all kinds of financing mechanisms set up where the studios and the exhibitors are working together on making that possible, but that is heavily reliant on credit from, you know, banks and so forth, and that has held up the rollout.
Well, okay, but there definitely is some kind of contention between the two players. I mean, for instance, Jim Giannopoulos, who's the head of the co-chair of Fox, recently told the theaters that he wasn't willing to pay for the 3D glasses, even though they have some big 3D titles coming out, like the new Ice Age movie.
Well, there's two, you know, major industries that work together, the exhibitors and the studios, and there are always questions about who pays how much for what, as there are in any business. And with respect to 3D, there are several issues. One is who's paying for the digital projectors. Second is who's paying for the 3D upgrade to the digital projector. And then on any given film, who's paying for the glasses for the consumers. And that's always a negotiation between both parties.
So Jeffrey Katzenberg, who is the head of DreamWorks Animation, he seems to think that in the near future, all movies will be 3D the way, or the majority of movies will be 3D the way all movies are now sound. How do you feel about that? What's your opinion on that?
I think that there's always going to be a mix of 2D and 3D, but my guess is that you will see the majority of the major films, there are probably 20 to 30 films a year that people feeler, the tentpole, the must-see films of the year. I would say it's likely that those films will be made in 3D at some point in the future.
But it's interesting that we're making these predictions, and you're certainly not alone. Steven Spielberg seems to agree with you. George Lucas seems to agree with you. But we don't even know if live-action 3D is really a viable thing for most people.
There have been several live-action pieces of content in 3D in the theaters, concert films like U2 3D,
right.
Hannah Montana in 3D, Jonas Brothers coming out in 3D, and the response has been very good to them. And anyone who has seen live-action 3D on high-quality screens has found it incredibly compelling. I mean, I saw a piece of Casablanca that someone made into 3D, actually, and it was really amazingly compelling. It actually helped draw you into the story because 3D becomes a partner in the storytelling process.
But it begs the question, will 3D, if it becomes the norm, change the kind of movies that we see? Will people stop making those a serious drama because they don't show off the 3D as well?
There are two issues there. One is, I think that we're getting beyond the spear in your face mentality where people are throwing 3D at you as an audience member. I mean, one of the most compelling parts of Coraline for me, for example, was the whole movie, you just get into the story and you sort of lose track of the fact that you're watching 3D. It just, you know, you're just enveloped in the story. And at the very end, after the credits roll, these mice come out of the screen and they float out into the middle of
right.
the audience. And to me, that was a way for Selleck to say, hey, we could have done this the entire movie, but we didn't.
Right.
You know, and so I think we're crossing that bridge right now to where filmmakers are saying, "Hey, this can be a really compelling way to make movies, and it's not about throwing things in the face of the audience."
It does seem like if the filmmakers can't get past the throwing the spear mentality, then these films remain a novelty, and that novelty wears off, and that 3D becomes the fad it was in the 50s. If they can incorporate it into filmmaking in a more natural way, then it becomes like sound, something that we expect.
There's no question in my mind that story and character are the heart and soul of film. And you can't make a bad film good by using 3D. So there's no, fundamentally, you've got to make great films.
Now, one of the reasons that the studios like 3D is because it's very difficult to sit in a theater with a handheld camera and pirate a 3D film. So that they're hoping that 3D will cut down on piracy, which is a huge issue for them. But on the flip side, it seems like it's also going to really cut down on home video sales, because if you loved a 3D movie in the theater, when you come home, you don't have the capability to watch it in 3D. Now, you are going to be speaking at the NAB show next Saturday, and one of your topics is about home video 3D, so 3D for your TV. Is that really coming?
Yeah, there are a lot of people working on it now, and a lot of the technologies are there. What we need to do is agree on how we're going to deliver it to consumers and work with consumer electronics manufacturers to make the stuff in such a way that we can, you know, reduce the price of it and get it down to a price point where it makes sense for consumers. So I think we can make it happen in the reasonably near future to get 3D into the home, which is what consumers are asking us for.
In the interim between the time that we have a lot of 3D movie theaters but no capability of doing 3D at home, does then home video suffer? You know, it's already suffering.
The studios have been trying to figure out creative ways of dealing with that. Last year, Warner Brothers put out Polar Express and Journey to the Center of the Earth on Blu-ray disc with anaglyph glasses, you know, old school red, blue glasses in the box. Not exactly the experience that they or consumers necessarily want, but it's a step. It's sort of an interim step to trying to satisfy some of the demand for 3D in the home.
Sounds like they acknowledge the problem.
Yeah, I mean, everybody recognizes that consumers are going to want to have some kind of 3D experience in their home after they've had it in the theaters. And the studios obviously want to have a way to deliver movies to people in home video. And, you know, and the consumer electronics manufacturers are interested in it as well.
So what I hear you saying is throw out your Blu-ray DVD player you just bought, because you're going to be buying the Blu-ray 3D player fairly soon. David Wertheimer.
Actually, I'm not saying that, because I don't think that's true.
You don't?
No, I don't.
You think that the DVD player as it stands will be able to do the 3D thing?
There are several technologies that we have in our lab today that can run on existing Blu-ray players that allow you to deliver 3D movies using existing off-the-shelf Blu-ray players.
Hmm. All right. David Wertheimer is the CEO and Executive Director of the Entertainment Technology Center at USC, a nonprofit consortium that brings top entertainment and technology companies together with next-generation consumers. He'll be speaking at the NAB show in Las Vegas, talking about 3D there this Saturday. David Wertheimer, thanks for coming on The Business.
Thanks. It was a real pleasure.
A postscript. Upgrading a theater to digital projection costs north of $75,000 per screen. Add 3D and you've got another $25,000 on top of that. There are nearly 40,000 screens in the U.S. alone, so do the math. You can see why the transition to 3D is taking its time. Everyone knows there are a lot of rich people in Hollywood. What's less well known is that show business people can be very generous, at least when it comes to charity. But this is Hollywood, where doing good works is a little like roller derby. Heather Thomas is one of the queens of that particular rink, and she's written about it in her novel, Trophies. She's best known for her role opposite Lee Majors on the 80s TV show The Fall Guy, and for her awe-inspiring pinup poster. But these days, she's an activist, philanthropist, and wife of Hollywood power lawyer Skip Brittenham. Her book, which just came out in paperback, is more than just a salacious yarn. She gives us a look at the anthropology of the modern-day Hollywood trophy wife.
Acquiring material things is good for about 5 minutes. Now, these are extremely competitive women. They're the second, third, fourth wives of billionaires.
Now, are we talking about the book now or real life?
Sort of both.
Okay.
When these men come on the market, it's not as though women are not going to notice. And so it is competitive to be their wife. And so what do they do with that drive once they grab the brass ring? You've got the kids in the private school. You've got the house. You've had the baby. All that stuff. What do you do with your time? You're not going to sit around and eat bonbons and shop. What are you going to do? What's the ultimate luxury? Service. And you don't want to just socialize with his friends that were friends with the ex-wife. You want to create your own friends. So it's a way of establishing yourself. It's a way of socializing. Unfortunately, these women are highly competitive. So then you add that competition. Depending on how insecure the woman is, it can get insane.
Yes, and how does that work? I mean, you want somebody to be at your thing, but you know somebody else wants that person to be at their thing. I mean, do you...
It's usually not same dates, because there are websites you can check to do your dates.
Okay.
When you set events. I think it's more like getting someone on the board, but it's not hideous competition until something occurs, like in my book, when one woman sort of identifies herself as the hospital lady. There's a man in the business who's no longer very prominent in the business, who is Mr. Hospital. And if you needed a doctor, you called him.
Right.
So here's a woman. She doesn't have a job, but she's Ms. Hospital.
Right.
Now, what happens if someone else who's a big star, Queen Bee, starts raising for a hospital? Where does that leave her?
Right.
And she actually goes through this huge identity crisis. Who will I be? You know, who will come to my parties? And won't we go to Marbella? It's their whole social life a lot of times. But a lot of people feel guilty for their wealth. A lot of people, everybody has a different agenda. Everybody has a different motivation. It would be a very easy world if we could blankety-blank say, this woman's like that, this, and they're exactly like this as a group. But what I wanted to do, being a natural iconoclast, I wanted to go and examine the image of the trophy wife, in quotations, as, you know, the vacuous, vegetable-brained arm charm on an old guy who's rich.
Coming up after a short break, more with Heather Thomas about the world of Hollywood fundraising and Hollywood power wives. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Heather Thomas about the world of Hollywood fundraising. She's best known for her role opposite Lee Majors on the TV show The Fall Guy and her famous pinup poster. But these days, she's an activist, philanthropist, and Hollywood power wife. She's written a novel called Trophies that exposes the turf wars in Hollywood fundraising.
Now, there's a whole genre of literature at this point, which, you know, Gigi LaVangie, soon-to-be ex-grazer, I don't know, did The Starter Wife. Candy Spelling has a book out. I mean, why did you decide to go for it?
Well, mine is an unmined area. It's the fundraising turf wars.
And did you worry? You're married to Skip Brittenham, who's obviously one of the most prominent lawyers. Did you worry? Was there a downside? Did he have to look at the book and say, don't write that because somebody might recognize Mr. Hospital?
No, because I'm not mean-spirited, and these are all fictional characters. And, you know, my girlfriends or women I've met or things I've witnessed, they serve as inspiration, but they're not necessarily interesting enough to put in a book. You want to, you know, tweak them and color them and delve into them a little bit deeper. And what was more interesting for me as an artist and as a writer was to look at motivation. And
right.
90% of these second wives, they're not old money.
No, they're new money.
Which makes sudden grandiose wealth makes for really fun hillbilly excess. So it's kind of fun.
So how much does a wife's power derive from the husband?
It depends. See, also, a lot of these women want to establish an identity apart from being, Gigi coined the term, wife of.
Right.
For me, I had more money than my husband when I married him. He was in the middle of a divorce, and I had just come off a TV series. I was in 72 countries when there were three networks, and I had the highest-selling poster of all time. So I was fine.
Right.
But if you came into it where your whole survival economically depends on what it says in the prenup or whether someone else will catch his eye, or you want to establish yourself. And these charities depend on a constant influx of young wives. I mean, I noticed when I married Skip, I was just a celebrity. I would go to the events and kind of stand around, smile, and throw him a check and get the heck out. And when I married Skip, it was like all of a sudden all these charities came out of the woodwork and wanted me on their board.
And is it because of the connection to Skip or because they figure you've got time and money on your hands?
Both.
Or both? Okay.
Well, you figure if you're married to a guy in the business, this is the key. They depend on young wives' constant influx because they bring with them lists, client lists, connection lists. They wanted Skip's phone book and my free time.
That's a powerful combination.
That's what they wanted.
So this whole world of Hollywood fundraising, what does it show us about the business of Hollywood? How does it mirror or amplify what goes on in the business?
I think people in the entertainment industry, by nature of being artists and empathetic and constantly looking for the human condition, the reasons why, not afraid to reveal the good, the bad, the ugly, I think they're more sensitive.
Really?
Because they're always looking at how does this look?
I thought you were going to say there's cutthroat competition in the business and there's cutthroat competition in the charity world, too.
Mm-mm, I think they're more generous.
Really? You think that's too dark a view?
I think we give and give and give till we bleed in this town.
Is it partly you think that the industry, you know, a lot of people feel sort of this industry guilt, you know, I'm rich and I don't know why I'm a star. It doesn't really, I don't get it. Why am I a star? That's my feeling about stars.
You can apply that to any wealthy social structure. You know, there's always going to be individuals that feel a certain guilt. That's just, you know, not knowing yourself very well. But I feel that there's an obligation to do service if you are blessed with more monetary things.
The wives are very powerful, right? They have a tremendous impact on how charitable funds are actually spent.
Think about it this way. These men are workaholics. A lot of them are rich because they're workaholics. They love what they do. They're very busy. They're not going to sit there and open an envelope and read about the charity. Who's saying, honey, I want to go to this event? I want to go hear Sting. He's playing at this party.
Well, I remember having a conversation some time ago with Jeffrey Katzenberg. We were sitting there, and he said, I have to find something for David, that being David Geffen. And I said, well, what about a school program? And he said, no, it has to be something built. It has to be a monument. In other words, it had to be something, the David Geffen School of Medicine or something like that, which we now have. So what you're saying is women don't feel quite the need to plaster their names all over things?
You know, I think that's when the hyperdrive competition goes wrong, you know, depending on the insecurity. It's I want to make the world a better place as long as I get more credit than Barbara.
Right.
Yeah, it does go wrong sometimes. And I've witnessed that. So I wrote a book. It was just these characters were talking in my head, and it was something that nobody had ever brought up really strongly. right. the charity
that,
arena.
That fundraising, that, the arena, battlefield, and the benefit of it all.
Yeah, and then there's some that are just roll merrily along and they don't, you know, really think either way about strategy and battle. But there are other women that really, really, you know, they need this. They feel that this is their identity. This is how they're going to establish themselves. And as a consequence, the charities do really well. And if you think about it, there isn't a building preserved. There isn't a building built. There isn't a public park. There isn't a spiritual leader. There isn't a national cause. There isn't a political group, a politician. There is not a disease researched. There's not a hospital built. There's not a program for children without the attention and seed money from some of these women. They're like the unsung backbone. Like someone might come up with a great idea, but if you don't have somebody to say, okay, I'll give you some money, and then, okay, I'll help you fundraise, which is really hard. They're professional fundraisers, but what if you can't afford them?
Right. I really am curious. You know, people don't, they sort of complain about fundraising events, and they whine about going to them, and yet they keep going. Is it because of the anthropology of Hollywood is you must go and you must be seen?
No. Some of it's quid pro quo. And some of it, they think it'll be a nice evening. And some of it, it depends on who's being honored. It's really arbitrary, but you have to see what you think will garnish you the most funds. Some people need to have an event with a huge singing star that makes them feel like they were 13 again. And it has to be an older singing star that resonates with a time when they felt young and cool. That's why you never see, like, current stars.
You don't see Rihanna doing these things.
Well, right? You do, but not as much.
Right. So you, when you want someone to come really badly, what do you say to them?
If you want them to attend or you want their check?
Both.
If you want both, then you say it really means a lot to me. But you can't do that with every single thing you're going to ask for.
And it really means a lot to me is code for?
You better get your butt in that seat or, you know.
What's the consequence?
It'll hurt my feelings. You know, you can do that. You know, if people really need to do that, to be that petty. But I think if somebody tells me it really means a lot to them that I and they really need my help for the donation and stuff like that, I weigh it all out. Well, you could go broke. We probably get about 200 solicitations a week.
Yeah, that's a lot. I would imagine mm-hmm. you do, at least. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how do you pick and choose?
Who's asking? The charity itself. Where the money goes to, you can research any charity to see if it's a functioning, you know, if it makes sense. What's going on in the world? Where our finances are? You know, there's a million things, and it's got to resonate with you because all charities are good. I work for the environment because I happen to feel that if the world ends,
that would be bad.
All charities are moot.
Yes. So,
and I also have been on the board of the Rape Foundation for about 20 years.
Heather Thomas is an actress best known for her role opposite Lee Majors in The Fall Guy, but she's also a political activist and fundraiser, and she's written Trophies, a novel based on her experience as a Hollywood power wife. Trophies just came out in paperback. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you have any questions or comments about the show, write us at thebusiness@kcrw.org. You can also listen to this or any past program, comment about the show, and engage with other listeners at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. Our theme music mashup was designed by our genius in-house beat architect, Jason Groman. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters, and we'll see you next week on The Business.